measures for rising growth performance. In view of the slow growth in the national income, there is an urgent need for stepping up the economy's performance. For this, a variety of measures need to be adopted. These can be discussed under the following main heads. Rationalizing production structure. To raise the growth rate, it is important that we reshape our production structure in a manner that it becomes compatible with our resources. This involves two things: an assessment of our resources and the use and development of most advanced technologies. The resources like the source of energy, land, water, essential materials, as also environment and ecology, are no doubt vital elements in the determination of potential for growth and comparative advantage of the country vis-a-vis other countries. However, technology, which is emerging as the most important factor in the growth scenario, is no less important. It can augment the resources by raising their productivity and conserving their use. It can even change the comparative advantage of the country by reducing costs. Taken together, that is, resources and technology, these should determine our capabilities. The emerging production structure will then be the best possible and will serve best the domestic demands and foreign demands. As a consequence, the growth rate will rise substantially. Given this approach, it is necessary to adopt measures along the following lines. 1. Foreign trade should be used as an important instrument to balance domestic production and demands. In other words, we export what we can produce comparatively cheaply and import goods in the production of which we are at a comparative advantage. In this context, one can think of the change in the production structure in two phases. At present, when we are faced with massive unemployment, we should tilt our production in favor of labor-intensive industries and import those goods which are less labor-intensive. This approach is feasible because we have labor in abundance, which is available at much lower wage rate compared to the advanced countries. However, this cannot be the long-term aim. With development, wages will rise. Again, the use of advanced technology will require comparatively more capital than labor. In fact, since technology gets embodied in machines, production becomes increasingly more capital intensive. Hence, in the second phase, growth has to be capital intensive. This alone can make our economy dynamic. This alone can provide a strong basis for an economy to produce in terms of the principle of comparative advantage. In this phase, we may have also to progressively vacate certain areas in which we do not enjoy comparative advantage. Alongside, we should specialize in areas in which we are better placed vis-a-vis other countries. 2. We should choose activities which can be expanded quickly and massively. One such area is agriculture and other land-based activities. These include dry land farming in the rain-fed areas, agro-processing and agro-business, animal husbandry, fish production, etc. In the non-agricultural sector, expansion of services too holds out a promise of large production. In the industrial sector, there are some industries which can be deemed as thrust areas for rising production. Some of these are very good for exports also. These are, for example, fertilizer industry, textile, finished steel, cement, electronic industry, etc. Now, the second measure for raising growth performance is capacity creation, maintenance, and utilization. The policy of higher investments has also to be continued. But the more important part of the policy henceforth should be to step up the rate of fixed capital formation and not of inventories or stocks. Of course, with increased activity, larger stocks become necessary, but one has to eliminate the unnecessary increases in stock. On the other hand, the growth rate of the fixed capital has been for quite many years rather low. Particularly in the public sector, the country needs more of construction for factories, machines, tools, etc. to provide the working population with large wherewithal to produce more output or income. Larger public sector investments are particularly crucial for the expansion of infrastructural facilities as also for generating demand in the economy. Additions to capital stock are, however, not enough. The existing capital must also be properly maintained. As for public investments are concerned, provisions are made for new investments in the plants and maintenance of the assets are left to the non-plan budgets. This results in the neglect of the precious assets. These require to be kept intact so that these continue to generate output. Equally importantly, it is necessary to ensure that these assets continue to be upgraded technologically. Little or improper maintenance amounts to reduction in the net capital formation. Hence, creation of capacity and adequate and proper maintenance of the already created capacity should be of equal importance. As such, some expenditure, preferably as part of plan outlays, be earmarked on the regular annual basis for repairs, replacements, etc., as also for the improvements of the output yielding assets. Still another aspect of the problem is related to the full use of capacity that is created. In the Indian economy, a large part of economy's capacity remains unutilized. Some estimates put the capacity utilization at present at around 78%, which has fallen from 85% in 1970 to 71. This malaise is to be seen in almost all the major sectors of the economy at one or the other time. Examples of some of such important industries are motor vehicle, electric motors, storage batteries, cement, fertilizers, machine tools, vanaspati, etc., where capacity utilized ranges from 58% to 80%. The non-use of the part of capacity amounts to wastage of resources which remain locked in these capacities. This also implies non-availability of output that can be made available with little cost of a variable nature. Of course, a part of the excess capacity is inevitable to meet the future rise in demands, as for example in the case of electricity, but quite a part of the unused capacity results from lack of demand both for consumer goods as also for capital goods. The farmer requires policies for income generation among the mass of the people through, for example, work creation and assets distribution, and the latter needs an increase in investment. The next measure is improving productivity and efficiency. Another fruit-bearing line is to step up the productivity and efficiency in the economy. The scope of the productivity improvement is really large in many sectors. Agriculture, for example, produces much less than is possible with existing resources. even in crops like wheat and rice, where yield per hectare in certain areas has gone up much, the productivity on an average is much lower than achieved by certain areas within the country and as compared to other countries. Similarly, in quite a number of industries, the output is much less than it can be. In quite many cases, the size of the plant is not large enough for bigger output. In some cases, a given output is produced by many small plants located in different regions rather than one integrated plant at the place and in the most convenient size. Or there may be management constraints which prevent the optimum from being realized. It is only by identifying the specific causes in specific industries that one can suggest the remedies for raising the productivity. Output increase through improvement in efficiency can largely come about from proper allocation of resources and better management of productive units. Proper allocation of resources implies such dispersal of resources among different lines that these balance demand and supply of the output of different producing units. In fact, quite a large part of the inefficient use of the existing capacity has been due to inadequacy in the balancing investments in the related sectors. As examples of some pairs of sectors requiring simultaneous investments to mutually reinforce each other, one may maintain the following. The first one, the construction of field channels that supply water to the field and the command area development program, which encompasses, among others, the creation of irrigation. The latter is a little use without the former, yet much investment have taken place in the latter with little investment on the former. Second, increase in output and improvements in the quality of coal have attracted much resources, but this is unmatched by an adequate transportation system. Third, outlays for generation, transmission and distribution of electricity have not been adequately provided for, resulting in surplus or shortages of various regions and consumers. Considered on a wider plane, it means that the production of such industries, in particular of infrastructure and intermediate goods like steel, cement, coal, railway transport, communication, irrigation, fertilizers, etc., should not become mutual bottlenecks for want of adequate resources. What is therefore needed is a better balance between the investment in the creation of new capacities and investment in the complementary sectors so as to ensure fuller use of capacities created. Better management of producing units is of no less significance. This requires more and more of professionalized services for the conduct of business enterprises. In the case of public sector enterprises which are not yielding adequate returns, it is imperative that management personnel is drawn from the managerial class rather than from the administrative cadre. Besides, a greater autonomy for decision making to the management has to be considered in respect of such vital matters as investments for modernization and replacements, choice of product mix, pricing of products, and hiring of labor. In addition, there is need for improvement in efficiency through training of the personnel at different levels. The next is enlisting workers' cooperation. In any effort at raising production, it is important to ensure that workers play their part fully. Their cooperation is essential for an uninterrupted operations of the plants. For effecting technical improvements in the production process, etc. The contributions of labor can increase much if they acquire a stake in the producing units. One line of solution lies in allowing the workforce a share of the fortunes of enterprise through, for example, a share of the management, as also by improving industrial relations. Such a course is bound to improve the work ethics, reduce absenteeism, and minimize loss of working days. All this will increase man-hour productivity. Appropriate measures are equally necessary in the agricultural sphere. These pertain to the speedy implementation of land reforms so as to improve upon the environment for the actual tiller of the soil. No less significant are incentives. These related to payment and rewards for more work and better results. These are to be such as protect the real earnings of those who produce. Those are relevant to both public sector as also to the private sector. This in turn implies suitable income and wage policies, which not only reflect the average level of productivity of the economy, but also incorporate the differentials that are necessary for promoting the skill formation at various levels. The next measure is fostering competition. In our economy with market predominant, competition has also to be promoted more vigorously than at present. This can substantially raise output, minimize costs, and improve the quality of products. The restrictions like physical controls imposed earlier when investment was very low are not wholly relevant at present, with the investment having gone up substantially. Earlier, it was necessary to divert maximum of resources to heavy and long gestating industries. Having built them up considerably, these controls need to be relaxed in general and removed altogether in case of many lines of activities. The induction of competition should, however, be so phased as does not suddenly disrupt the working of the economy. Since quite many enterprises have for long worked under various kinds of shelters, example, improved restrictions, licensing, price administration, etc., it is necessary to devise such doses of competition and in a manner in the initial stages. These reduce and ultimately eliminate various inefficiencies of the economy, such as high costs, shoddy products, unfair deals, unsatisfactory services, etc. The next measure is reducing population growth. The above mentioned measure bear upon the output of the economy directly. Indirectly, however, the measures to reduce population growth will also be helpful in this regard in two ways. One, it will make available large resources for investments. Since the overall needs for private consumption goods like food, clothes, etc., and public consumption goods like transport, electricity, etc., will become less, there will be larger savings both in the private sectors and public sector. This can be used for building more capacity in the economy. Second, there will be an immediate gain in terms of per capita income and therefore in the welfare and to an extent in the consumption levels. In fact, in quite many plans, the population projections have gone wrong, reducing the projected rise in the per capita income. Therefore, to accelerate the growth rate, both in terms of the size of the national income as also of the per capita income, reduction in population growth is of greater importance. So, measures of raising growth performance are rationalizing production structure, capacity creation, maintenance and utilization, improving productivity and efficiency, enlisting workers' cooperation, fostering competition and reducing population growth. Now coming to the next subheading, raising national income, alternative approaches. Since the growth rate of national income has been slow, quite a few have suggested radical departures from the present approach underlying the strategy of India's planned development. Some even in the beginning of the planned era wanted the country to opt for a different path of growth from the one adopted in the second plan. Among the alternatives suggested, one is that which assigns a key role to the supply of wage goods in the development profile of the economy. This is known as wage goods strategy. Another alternative of inducing output increases via Keynes's multiplier has been discussed, although regarded by many as an unfit tool for economy in the present stage of development. We, however, touch upon this also to acquaint ourselves with it to find out as to why what has worked in developed countries does not suit us. Wage goods approach. The view that the supply of wage goods is crucial for the growth has been put forward as a counter proposal to the Mahalanobis strategy of giving the highest priority to the rapid building up of the capital stock of the country. This view found further acceptance with the passage of time as the problems of unemployment and poverty became more serious, despite many successes in the creation of large infrastructure and capital goods industries. Mahalanobis strategy and shortage of wage goods. Ever since the adoption of the strategy for fast and massive creation of capital-intensive capital stock devised by Mahalanobis, there has been a slower growth in the production of such items of consumption as cereals, pulses, edible oil, cloth, kerosene, soap, etc. that constitute wage package in real terms. In fact, alongside the inadequacy of these goods and also because of it, their prices have also been on the rise. Putting these goods beyond the purchasing capacity of the substantial part of population, with emphasis on capital intensive industries under the Mahalanobis plan, there could be but little resources that could be devoted to the production of wage goods, nor could there be much growth in employment because of the less labor intensive nature of the capital goods industries in the country. The critics in fact say that the inadequacy of the supply of wage goods, which was the direct consequence of the strategy, was at the root of unemployment in the country. These critics do concede the benefits, example, establishment of vast industrial capacity, self-reliance in many fields, some modernization of the economy, etc., of this strategy, but they regard unemployment or poverty as the price paid for these benefits. They also concede the rapid rise in population as an important factor in the present situation marked by unemployment. But for them, the most important thing is the inadequate supply of wage goods. Priority for wage goods. This approach envisages a rapid increase in supply of goods which constitute items of real wages. According to it, the expansion of wage goods in the wage goods industries should be large enough to sustain further expansion of wage goods industries and to create surpluses for generating employment in other sectors. particularly in rural capital formation. The premise of this approach is that it is the supply of wage goods that determines the quantum of employment. This, of course, is true because employment in any sector presupposes the adequacy of wage goods. These advocates of this theory regard the growth of unemployment in the country as the consequence of chronic shortage of wage goods in relation to the employment-seeking population. Obviously, when a large part of resources is devoted to wage goods industries, the capital goods sector will to that extent go short of resources. This is sometimes opposite to the Mahalanobis model of higher priority to capital goods industries and lower priority to the wage goods industries. Following this logic of higher priority to wage goods, the advocates of this approach seek import of capital goods to make up for shortfall of capital goods. To realize this, they look for increase in export via the creation of surplus in the light industries. These light industries are additionally useful because these can be spread around the entire country and can therefore be helpful in the generation of employment income in a decentralized fashion. Capital goods industries too are favored, provided these are such as have high employment potential and can create jobs in short run. Example, industries for construction of feed channels, roads, storage, etc. Wage goods strategy. It may be useful here to recall also a small line advocated since the beginning of planning in the country, designated as the extended wage goods strategy. It consists of several components. The centerpiece, of course, is the expansion of wage goods required for subsistence and performance of work, priority for the development of those capital goods which are necessary for the production of wage goods. The supply of output from the integrated wage goods complex, that is consumption necessities plus capital goods involved in their production, to grow at the substantially higher rate than population to absorb openly disguised unemployment. Further, because of the higher labor productivity of output than required for initial consumption intake, there will be larger expansion of output capacity. Also, there will be higher saving income ratio in any given period of the initial expansion in wage goods supplies. Moreover, since the capital output ratio is lower, the savings and capital requirements are lower than in the case of capital intensive capital goods industries. In other words, as a given savings income ratio, the average growth rate will always be higher. In addition, there will be an egalitarian effect with employment to those in low subsistence and low income sectors. The development process will also be diffused and will cover primarily the rural sector, as the needs for economic overheads for this strategy are minimal. This strategy will be non-inflationary with the inbuilt capacity for output expansion and saving promotion in the strategy. Self-reliance will also be promoted, as the bulk of investment in the initial stages do not imply dependence upon foreign capital or foreign technology. With the maximization of output efficiency and the high speed in the production of consumption necessities, the investment sector too will become somewhat labor intensive. This strategy is to be accompanied by the program of population stabilization, control of money supply, public distribution, and a high long-term rate of interest to encourage saving.
Now the fifth approach is employment and eradication of poverty. In the light of the present-day pressing problems, the wage goods approach can be viewed as an attempt to generate faster employment or income, as poverty is nothing but another name of unemployment. However, this view needs to be neatly distinguished from the earlier attempts with the same objectives. This view doesn't emphasize labor-intensive industries in wage goods industries as such. Under the Mahalanobis scheme of things, the production of consumer goods was left to small and cottage industries on the ground that these require less capital resources and that these are essentially labor-intensive industries. Even the now abandoned sixth plan, that is from 1978 to 83, attached great importance to labor-intensive industries and employment-generating schemes as such. Neither of the two approaches, the Mahalanobis and the sixth plan, attached much importance to the question of productivity of labor in these industries. The main, if not the sole, objective and the rationale of these industries was employment generation. So much was the emphasis on this aspect that the draft plan, that was from 1978 to 83 again, even took note of the fact that the output to labor ratio would fall over a wide range of industries, that is, a decline in productivity. This is not the case of wage goods approach. It, on the other hand, emphasizes the need for efficient techniques that can bring about rapid increase in the wage goods supplies. This means employment, higher wages, and therefore eradication of poverty. Now we'll look into the rationale and relevance. Whatever may be the justification of this wage goods approach in the past, it has at present a good appeal. Having built up a large capital stock and human capital and raised domestic savings to a reasonably high level, the country can afford a shift in favor of this approach for the sake of employment and removal of poverty. Implied in this approach is the postponement of the rapid building up of capital stock. Such a thing may not be necessary or may not mean much in real terms in view of the present large capability to produce capital goods and existing large underutilized capacity in this sector. Again, emphasis on wage goods industries, light industries, and labor intensive capital formation in this order will reduce disparities of incomes class wise and region wise. Concern with efficient techniques will look after the question of incomes. There is thus a rationality in leaning towards this approach in view of the country's capability built up so far. More so because this has acquired a relevance to the present situation marked by large unemployment and poverty. Now the next thing is Keynesian multiplier. Another approach implied in the Keynes theory of income and employment and based on the concept of multiplier has often been subjected to analysis to see if this could form the basis of our efforts at raising the growth rate. But the dice has always been loaded against it, whether scrutinized at general theoretical level or tested empirically in the frame of events in the Indian economy. However, in search for a way out of the slow growth of the economy, a discussion of the same will be rewarding. Now, meaning of Keynesian multiplier. However, before we discuss the relevance or irrelevance of the Keynesian multiplier, it is good to familiarize ourselves with the concept. A straightforward way of doing so is to say that it is a figure or number that is obtained by dividing the resulting change in income by a change in expenditure. For example, if the income has changed, let us say it's increased by Rs. 500 as a result of change in expenditure, let's say it's increased by Rs. 100, then the multiplier is 5. That is because change in income is 500 and change in expenditure is 100 rupees. So if we divide 500 by 100, we'll get 5. That is the multiplier. Put in the form of the use of this concept, one can say that if expenditure rises by rupees 100, then the multiplier number at 5, the income will go up by rupees 500. The multiplier is thus a measure of the effect on total national income of a unit change in some component of aggregate expenditure. But how to know the value of multiplier? Let's take an example. Suppose the government undertakes investment expenditure of rupees 100 on public works like roads, schools, buildings, etc. We should expect that the national income would rise by the amount of this expenditure. The investment expenditure is paid out as wages, salaries, profits, etc. to suppliers of factor services. The recipients will save a part. Suppose it's 20% or 20 rupees of their income and spend the rest, that is 80 rupees. Their expenditure will further raise the output of goods and services on which they spend. This will raise the incomes of others. That is rupees 80 what they spend. That will be income for others who produce these goods. Whatever these people buy, spending 80 rupees, it will be the income for those who sell those goods. The result now will be original increase in income of rupees 100 plus the subsequent increase of rupees 80. The recipients of rupees 80 will again save a part, let us say 20%, and spend the rest, let us say 80%, and so on, ad infinitum. The result is that the total increase in national income resulting from the initial increase in investment will in the end be several times larger than the increase in investment. It will be a multiple of the increase in investment. The value of this multiple is the multiplier, and the overall effect is called the multiplier effect. In our example, at every round of income generation, 80% is re-spent. This means that the proportion of expenditure from the increase or additional income is 0.8, or that is 80% again. This is called the marginal propensity to consume. Okay, because we saw that in all the cases, whatever the people spend, that is 80% of their income they spend, and 80% of that spent is spent by the person who gets that money. Okay, that's the reason that the marginal propensity to consume is 80%. Or MPC, that is called marginal propensity to consume, or MPC for short. For one can say that the marginal propensity to save, or MPS, that is marginal propensity to save, that is MPS, is 20% or 0.2. So that MPC, that is marginal propensity to consume, is, we can take up a formula here, that is K. K will be the multiplier. K, that is multiplier, that is equal to 1 divided by 1 minus MPC, that is marginal propensity to consume. See, 1 divided by 1 minus MPC. 1 minus MPC, that is MPS. So the multiplier becomes 1 divided by MPS. 1 is the total unit in that. For example, we spend 80%, and in all levels of income generation, 80% of that was spent. So marginal propensity to consume is 80%. If we deduct 80% by 1, we get the remaining 20%, which is marginal propensity to save. So the multiplier is equal to 1 divided by 1 minus MPC, that is again 1 divided by MPS. Given the multiplier, if one knows the original investment expenditure, one can know the total increase in national income. In this example, the multiplier is 5. Suppose the original investment is rupees 1000 crore, then the national income will rise as a result by rupees 5000 crores. Thus, if MPC, that is marginal propensity to consume, is high, multiplier will be high, and the effect on national income of an initial investment will be high. High MPC in India. In a poor country like India, the MPC is very high. This is because at a lower income, most of it is taken away by or spent upon acquiring the necessities of life. At this low level, a further increase in income does not affect much the MPC, which remains high. If MPC is high, multiplier is also high. This suggests that Keynesian tool can be used to affect income or output very favorably in a country like India. In fact, it is this fact of high MPC and therefore large multiplier that aroused the curiosity of many about the feasibility of approaching the problem of income or output expansion or growth via Keynesian economics. Relevance in developed countries. In developed countries, this has worked in a circumstances associated with the depression phase of the economies. During that phase, workers are idle, seeking work but not getting it. That is, they are in involuntary unemployment. There is idle capacity in consumer goods industries, but which is not being utilized fully for want of demand for their goods. Such countries have capital and technical know-how to meet the rising demand for capital goods, but this too is not in full use during depression. In brief, the economy is capable of producing more, but it is not doing so for want of demand. In these circumstances, an increase in demand will act as a tonic for the economy. Government can put in money in the pockets of workers by undertaking public works program. These workers in turn spend a part of it on consumption goods, the proportion spent depending on MPC. Such a course will, through multiplier, raise the output or income by a much larger figure, depending upon the original dose of the government investment and the value of multiplier. Now, we'll study the assumptions of the theory. When applying to underdeveloped countries, one should be clear about the circumstances of advanced countries that have made its operation there smooth and fruitful. This can be identified in terms of the assumptions underlying this theory, which hold true in a developed country. Four such assumptions are as follows. The first one is involuntary unemployment. There should be involuntary unemployment, excess capacity in consumption or goods industries, elastic supply of working capital such as raw materials, and an economy with rising supply curve. Do these assumptions hold good for an underdeveloped country? No. That is not true. So, these assumptions are true only in the developed country. Now, we'll look at the lack of involuntary unemployment. Why there is lack of involuntary unemployment? The involuntary unemployment of the type implied in the Keynesian model is not to be found in underdeveloped countries. It is associated with the advanced capitalist economies. The workers over there are wage laborers and the production is for sale in the market. Now, this is not the predominant feature of the backward agricultural countries. Most of the farming operations are conducted through family labor, who are non-wage workers. Wage laborers constitute a small part, and many of them are not paid wholly in money, as is in the case of industrial countries. Production in the countries is mostly for self-consumption. The amount marketed is a very small proportion of the total output. As such, there is no idle labor in involuntary unemployment. Laborers are working without wage payments and producing mostly for self-consumption. Their unemployment is disguised. The important point is that they are not available for the asking. Lack of excess capacity in consumption goods industries. The assumption of excess industrial capacity to produce consumer goods that exist in advanced countries is also not valid for a country like India. Agriculture supplies most of the consumer goods for the population, but agricultural production, in particular food grains, which constitute the bulk of wage goods, cannot be expanded to the dictates of increase in demand. In any case, this is true for the short period where nature cannot be made to yield results as per our short-term objectives. In the case of industrial consumer goods, the situation is no happier. The shortage of capital stock is a big constraint on the capacity. Overall, it can be said that a mere increase in demand as per Keynesian theory cannot by itself make land ooze out more food articles or factories to turn out a large supply of consumption goods. But the third assumption is less elastic supply of working capital. No less important is the hurdle that arises from the inadequate responses from the supply of raw materials or such like inputs for production, whether industries need agricultural raw materials or others, maybe minerals, there is a real difficulty in having them in adequate quantities. If and when the demand conditions are favorable, in agriculture the potential capacity for more production may be there, but this cannot be realized as the infrastructure in the form of irrigation, transport, etc. is far from the satisfactory. So is the case of raw materials which are mined. There too India has the knowledge of their great potential, but the capacity to acquire them is far below the potential.